My name's Andrea, and I'm a Greater Toronto Anglican. I came with this question because this is something that's been genuinely puzzling me. And like you're really cool. You give a great presentation, and it's really I really understand it because I'm just a lay person. But one thing that's been puzzling me about mental health and Toronto, because this is where I live, is as I age, more and more of my friends, I have to take them to the emergency ward, or go with them, because it's really not good to go to an emergency ward by yourself. And what I find is, and you're really cool and educated, and you seem to understand this, all this, but I would like to say that some of your colleagues on the front line are very, very disdainful of people with mental health issues. And I'm talking about, you know, people, when they have to go to the front desk, like, in the first place, none of my friends will go to a place if they've got any relationship, any kind of psychological or psychiatric treatment. They won't go to that emergency ward. They'll go to another one. But as soon as they have to say what medications they're on, they get treated differently. And I've seen a case where one friend really, really needed surgery, and she was blown off. And it was almost too late. She survived, but it was almost too late. So why is this happening in this day and age? I mean, you're really enlightened, obviously, but, why is this still happening at the front lines?
Yeah, you know, so that's a great question. When I go back to the MPA project, that's really what that's all about, which is really trying to increase the amount of understanding across all of care from the front line. I can't find it here. From the front line to be able to recognize and treat people respectfully and thoughtfully as well. So I think it's a work in progress. I think it's getting better. I think when I look at my 30 years or so practicing psychiatry, things are a lot different than they were now than they were before, and I think they're just getting better and better. But there's a lot of way to go in that area. I think education is part of it. I think the more we educate people, the better they're going to be. I think other areas of medicine have had stigma as well, if you think about it. Think about HIV when it came along. Think about people's experience there. Even cancer, going back a little bit further from that, was people were, didn't want to be near. There were separate cancer hospitals, right, because people didn't want to have the cancer patients with the other patients. So I'm very hopeful that we're transitioning through that, but I agree it's important for all of us to speak up and to make sure that we get what we deserve and also call people if they're not being respectful about it. So it's a great point.
Just a comment, actually, that I would highlight something I don't think you mentioned is the importance of exercise. And I know people, who were patients that were strongly opposed to meds. And I think medication has its place. Maybe not right out of the gate, but many patients I've met believe, go the exercise route, and it's stressed a little bit more. It can be just as effective, if not more, than some medication. So I think with meds and healthy lifestyle, I think I'd really highlight that. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I think. Oh, see, this is working now. I think I think exercise looks like a really great thing for anything that ails you. It really looks like it's very promising. The data just keeps coming out, and certainly for mental health, it looks like it's really good. There's great data for depression helping depression, exercise helping depression, kids with ADHD. There's a lot of really just getting people into, after school sports were a great idea for a lot. You get a kid out and get them to exercise and exhaust them, and then that really helps them focus. Probably lots of parents do that anyways without it being not just for ADHD, but a very strong signal. The dementia work, really good evidence there as well. So lifestyle, absolutely. I think exercise, diet, Those things are incredibly important factors. I don't think I would counsel someone to say, look, if you don't want to take the medication, exercise is going to help you. I think it all depends on the situation. I think if people are anxious or depressed, to some level, you can have a lot of choices, but if it gets beyond a certain point with psychosis or suicidal thoughts or those kinds of things, I think you get into a different category where you probably have to think of a more holistic approach. But I think that's what I talked a little bit about, the investment in, you know, family health teams and the resources that are there. Lots of people want to try sort of more mainstream or gentler routes to try and get better before they end up seeing a psychiatrist or going on medication. And I think that makes a whole lot of sense. A little bit of CBT works really well. Exercise is a great, great strategy. So thanks for bringing that up, Jackie.
Trevor, I once heard that there might be a correlation between post-Vatican II, when the Roman Catholic Church took the confessionals out, that there was a rise in psychotherapy and one-on-one therapy. That as you remove one, the other takes off. Do you think there's a correlation?
Well, I've never heard of that before, but you know, I don't know. I'm not sure that I buy the psychotherapy as confession model completely. I think I think people can do well with psychotherapy and confession, and at times. I mean, I think it's I think we do pretty well as Anglicans having a congregational confession rather than in the confession booth. I think, I don't know. So good to try and stimulate a little provocation here, Andrew, but I'm not going to bite. So. Were there other questions?
Yes. I'm Linda, St. James Anglican. Dr. Young, when the money does come from the federal government for dedicated for mental health, if you had your way, how would you disperse that money? You mentioned something about family health practices. But I know from family experience that the cognitive depression behavioral therapy has many people waiting long times before they have access to it. Do you want to have more of that? Do you want to do more research? How would you allocate the money?
Yeah. Well, all I can say is I have an incredible amount of respect. So I commend our elected politicians for the hard work that they do to try and figure out how to prioritize things in healthcare. I think there's no easy answer, and whatever decision you make, people could want to see it a different way. And I only speak as a private kind of citizen and as a practicing psychiatrist. I really think that the access is the thing, and I think what you mentioned, the access to early psychotherapy, to me is, if I had to choose, that's what I would want to see, because I think it does so, again, going to that early intervention part of it. I certainly think that there's a real lack of psychotherapy. You might see a psychiatrist and get medication and look for psychotherapy. If you have money, it's fine. You can see a private psychologist, but if you don't, you can be often stuck. So I definitely would say that would be a priority. Research is incredibly important as well. It's a bit of a different, and it all comes from the same place, but it's hard for me to, I wouldn't want to have to judge, those two. But I certainly think early, more access for people at an earlier level is the first thing that we need. And I'm not the only one who thinks that. I think most people would say that.
My name is Angela. I'm a parishioner here. You mentioned mindfulness, and we read a lot about that these days. Could you explain to us exactly what that is?
I'm sure I can't explain exactly what it is, but I can try a little bit. And again, that goes into the category of my talk about mental health and spirituality, an area and I know a lot less about than some of the things I spoke about before. Mindfulness, though, is a practice which is in its tradition of meditation, and there's many forms of it, but the main thing is to make yourself present and to slow down and to look at the benefits of that. And it's really about, so how the model in depression really simplified and, again, horribly, you know, could be way, just explained way better. But I think it's a one model with depression is instead of trying to push away the bad feeling, it's trying to help yourself be present in the moment, a lot like we do in prayer as well, just kind of taking the good and the bad together and having a kind of hope, you know, there that it's going to, you're going to get through that. So mindfulness is the practice of being able to let yourself increasingly be able to be present with the good and the bad, and then find a way of being able to accept that as part of you. That's kind of the basis of what it is. I tried mindfulness. I couldn't do it. I tried it for a little while. I do okay with prayer. I'm pretty good. I'm pretty got a, Andrew would say I probably need more practice than that. But I think mindfulness is that's. Oh, there you go. You have a, there you have somebody. Am I getting it right so far?
You follow a course to be trained over a couple of months, six, I can't remember how long. You go once a week, and you're trained in meditation and being aware of your entire body, so it's used with pain management, for example, and can drastically, I speak from experience, reduce the amount of drugs you're on for heavy meds for pain. But also the thing that I find that it does, to some extent, is by concentrating on very little, but being present and thinking about your breath, for example, and being aware of all the stuff coming through your head and saying, that's just a thought. It kind of turns down the static in your brain a bit so that it's not so full of chatter.
Hi, my name's Mary. I'm at St. James. As a family member, it can be very difficult to help someone with mental health issues. And I've seen it, I've had it personally and with my dear friends who face so many barriers with the physicians in the hospitals and trying to get them, get the care that they need, even in with their residences. And I'm just wondering, there's a lot of great work happening for the person who's dealing with the mental health issue, but what about the caregivers?
Yeah, so that's a big topic, a big area of interest. There are a couple of great examples where that's working. I know at Sinai Hospital, there's a big, the Reitman Center for family members dealing with people with dementia. That's one great example. I know Sunnybrook has the Family Navigation Project, which is really, they do a lot of adolescent psychiatry, really trying to engage the family there. I know as well CAMH has a lot of work in that area. It's still an area we need to do a lot more for. People do better with family, right? I mean, just in general, people do better with family. And if you've got an illness, you do better with family. I certainly find, you know, my practice, I mainly looked after patients with bipolar disorder, which is a pretty tough thing to deal with. It really does take a lot out of you, and people can behave in a way that it's hard for people to, family members to stick by them. You know, if you get manic and you sort of spend all the money that the family has, or you're unfaithful to your partner, or those kinds of things, it's hard for people to sometimes get beyond that. When it's an intimate level, it's easier for us when we're, you know, in a professional relationship or in a bigger network, but a one-on-one, a lot of people find it hard. I think what happens, what I really notice is people get worn out. People can be there for a couple of episodes, but after a while, you just get worn out. You just get depleted, and that's a big area for us to focus on, is keeping people engaged, because, as I said, a lot of people end up having to struggle with keeping well for many, many decades, and doing that with your family is going to be way easier than it is doing it alone. In schizophrenia, if you're psychotic and you're suspicious, that's really hard to connect with people as well. If you have a family member and you're afraid of them, and every time you see your family member, they're you know, they push you away or they say terribly hurtful things as well. It's really hard to stick by. And I think we know a little bit more family groups, CMHA, Friends of Schizophrenia, many of the there's many groups, eating disorders, et cetera, where there's lots of family members that support one another. That helps a whole lot. Getting involved as a peer counselor, if you're a family member, and sharing that with people, that really helps a lot.
I do as well practice mindfulness, but there's yoga and there's Tai Chi. And there's a simple thing: when you take a sip of water, where is that water going? You know, we sip water and we take it for granted. You're sipping water, just think about what's it doing to your body as it goes through your body. As you stand, you know, where are my feet? Those kinds of things, a very kind of self-awareness of yourself. Do you have to react to something because something needs to be reacted to? Or you can just sit back and let it pass and think about it. But the real thing that I wanted to say is you talked about the younger people and mental health, but there's the other end of the scale, and that's older people more and more being diagnosed with dementia and Alzheimer's. Are there any studies being done? And if so, what is some of the data that's coming out of that?
Yeah, I just mentioned a little bit about dementia. Showed you some of the data. It's a huge number, and it's a big thing for us all as a society to kind of grapple with. I think it's fair to say we don't have great treatments once dementia sets in. I think we have a few things, all the treatments that have been there, and I'm not a dementia expert. But in general, we can slow down a dementia, which is helpful. So if you're getting the symptoms, if you can slow down, so somebody, if you know where you're heading, at least you can get your life in order and you can sort out what you need to do with your family. You can get into the care that you need, so you're not doing that in a rushed way. So there's some benefit to that. I think any more time without being demented is wonderful. If it's 6 months or a year, that's really worth it. So that's one thing that I can say about it. But the big thing now is, as I said, trying to get new treatments. And there's this whole interest in inflammation and trying to get an immune therapy which shuts down inflammation in brain early and then kind of prevents it. The amyloid plaques you probably heard about in dementia, a lot of that that's just a way that the brain tissue is responding to inflammation. That's an inflammatory pathway. So it's really trying to figure out how to really stop that inflammation pathway from getting turned on really early. Multiple sclerosis is another example where inflammation is really big, and you may have seen there's trials of people giving stem cells to people with multiple sclerosis, and there's at least people looking better. It's almost like an immune reset. So some people have thought about the immune model or inflammation model for depression as well, and it's almost like we have to do a kind of really big reset early. So I talked about ketamine as that treatment. That's like a reset button. It's like we're trying to get treatments that are going to do something early rather than waiting until the symptoms are there when it feels like often a bit of a losing battle. But dementia in a family member is a really tough thing to deal with. I guess the hope is that we'll find an earlier cure for it.